Hello, and welcome to the Story of Singapore, Episode 7, Bootstrapping. Before we begin, I have three corrections to make. In Episode 5, I referred to the East India companies as partially state-owned enterprises, when actually they were government-granted monopolies which have been given rights, often exclusive rights, to trade, explore, and colonize. Of course, the founders of these companies had strong political ties and backdoors to their respective monarchies and patrons, basically any political elites who sponsor money, gifts, endorsements, and other kinds of support in return for profits or favors. But these companies only ever became state-owned when they ran into great financial ruin and had to be nationalized to prevent the collapse of their affiliated colonies and achieve much-needed stability. For now, we are still a few decades away from the nationalization of the British East India Company and another few more before its eventual dissolution. In Episode 6, I briefly mentioned why Spanish coinage was commonly used as money even by the British in Southeast Asia. But I am not quite satisfied with the explanation, so I shall elaborate more on that bit. Coins are usually what we call commodity money, an asset which carries intrinsic value due to the value of the material it is made of. One of the main problems that early coins faced was that they were made of soft metal, and thin shavings could be collected by trimming their edges. Shaved coins have tiny reductions in their actual value, but because they appear physically unchanged to the untrained eye, their perceived value remains unchanged. When you have collected enough shavings, you could melt them and effectively create more coins. This would not be a major problem if one person is doing it, but if a coin is shaved each time it changes hands and enough people are doing it, the value of current coins in the economy would be drastically reduced, while new coins would be injected into circulation, leading to uncontrolled inflation. To counter the issue of coin debasement and counterfeiting, coin mills would imprint patterns on the faces and mark the rims with stripes that would be destroyed in the shaving process. Spanish coin mills just so happened to be the best at these countermeasures at the time, and therefore the most widely circulated currency among colonists. In that same episode, I also mentioned that William Farquhar was married to a Malay woman, but the reality seems much murkier, and sources appear to conflict with one another. The woman was of French-Malay descent, living in Malacca, and became acquainted with the man when he was the chief administrator of the city in 1795. While they would go on to have 6 children together, it was unclear whether they were ever officially married or not. It was most likely the case that she remained his mistress until his sudden departure from Southeast Asia in just about 4 years' time. For now, Farquhar is the resident of a newly colonized but severely underdeveloped British settlement of Singapore. It goes without saying that Dutch reaction to this British encroachment was immediate and decidedly one of anger. It undermined the Dutch sphere of influence in the Malay archipelago and threatened to break its monopoly of control in the region. They declared the British agreement with Sultan Hussein and Temenggong Abdul Rahman invalid and demanded their withdrawal from Singapore at once. Back in the London headquarters, British company officials and politicians were panicking. Word had been sent to the British India office in Calcutta, forbidding Raffles from undertaking the mission to establish a new trading post in Southeast Asia. But due to the distance between Britain and India, the message arrived too late. Lord Hastings, the Governor General of India, had already granted permission, and Raffles had long gone on his merry way. Upon receiving the news of Singapore, the London office and the British Foreign Affairs Ministry disavowed his actions, claiming to the Dutch government in Amsterdam that Raffles had only been given power to make commercial arrangements, not political ones like deciding who was the rightful sultan. To make matters worse, back in Singapore, both Sultan Hussein and Temenggong Abdul Rahman realized the gravity of the situation and subsequently wrote to the Johor Riau court to express regret and seek forgiveness, alleging that they had been coerced by the British into signing the treaty. Farquhar later managed to convince them to recant their statements, but part of the damage had already been inflicted. Dutch officials in Southeast Asia were priming for an attack. Given how Dutch forces in the region heavily outnumbered British troops in Singapore, it was clear that Singapore needed reinforcements, and quick. The closest British colony to Singapore that could supply infantry and artillery to garrison the island was Penang. However, the governor of Penang rebuffed calls for aid. It appeared that the founding of Singapore was not just a contentious issue between the Dutch and the British, but also between the rivaling colonial authorities of Penang and Bencoolen. Geographically, Penang is much closer to Singapore than Bencoolen is. Yet, the island was under the jurisdiction of Raffles, the Lieutenant Governor of Bencoolen, which just seemed like an overreach of his power. Probably hoping for the Dutch to undo Raffles' pet project, the Governor of Penang then urged Farquhar to leave his post, but Farquhar stood fast. This was the last chance that the British had to secure a new base in Southeast Asia, and he was not about to abandon what he too had been advocating for years. War was looming. Farquhar and what little troops he had in Singapore would have to face the wrath of the Dutch alone. Strangely, nothing happened. There was no battle, no war, nothing. As it turned out, mixed messages from the British really confused the Dutch. The official word by all parties was that the issue of Singapore was indeed a transgression on the part of Raffles. But the bureaucrats in London were not yet informed of the exact circumstances of the event. The British East India Company was also divided into two camps. While one camp believed it was important to break Dutch hegemony in Southeast Asia to secure maritime trade between Britain and China, the other camp was in favour of relinquishing contestation of the Malay archipelago altogether in exchange for consolidating Dutch holdings in India instead. Moreover, based on the current Malay laws of succession, neither Sultan Hussein nor Sultan Abdul Rahman was officially the Sultan. The muddy political situation within the Johor Riau Sultanate meant that there was no clear-cut way of settling the dispute. These extenuating circumstances led the Dutch to moderate their response and prevented escalation into military action. Dutch inaction bought the British East India Company in Calcutta valuable time to arrange for funds and reinforcements to shore up the defence of Singapore. In the meantime, the Dutch and British governments began negotiations in July 1820 to discuss the matter of Singapore, along with other points of contention stemming from the original Anglo-Dutch Treaty of 1814. However, the revised treaty would not be finalized until 1824, and by then, the geopolitical realities around Singapore would be radically different. While the politicians joust with one another, Farquhar got down to business. If Raffles was the mastermind behind Singapore, then Farquhar was pretty much the heart, the hands, the legs, and really everything Singapore needed to survive. Now, before we dive into Farquhar's administration, let us set the scene. The February 1819 Singapore Treaty posed significant limitations for the British. Firstly, the British did not acquire or own the whole of Singapore, or even a fraction of its territory. They were merely renting a small but undefined plot of land from the Sultan and Temenggong to build a trading post for merchants to exchange goods and services. Secondly, the British did not hold a majority power, even within the bounds of their leased area. Authority was divided equally among the three parties, only within the allotted commercial district, and the British had no say in local matters outside the zone. Thirdly, the British had a duty to protect the Sultan and Temenggong from external threats, but abstained from intervening in any internal quarrels. In return, the Sultan and Temenggong would neither take part in treaties with any other nations, nor permit any other colonial powers to establish a settlement or trading post in Singapore. So, contrary to popular belief, British powers on the island were highly restricted early on. Before Raffles left Singapore, he gave Farquhar a set of instructions to guide his development. To the company directors, the colony of Bencoolen had been a thorn in their sides, but could not be abandoned because it still represented an economic foothold into a potentially lucrative region. If Singapore were to become another company liability, it would only further sully his reputation. Hence, Raffles forbade Farquhar from requesting for additional funding from the company. His administration of Singapore would have to operate without any startup capital. Dutch and Malay ports in the region had been imposing high taxes and trade restrictions on merchants, which severely dampened business profits. Other than its prime position along the highly trafficked Strait of Malacca, Singapore alone offered no other key advantages because it lacked natural resources, products, and currently infrastructure. To undercut the existing competition, Raffles designated Singapore as a free port, turning it into the first and at the time the only tax haven in the region for these traders. On the flip side, this also meant that Farquhar could not earn government revenue by levying duties on imports and exports. When Raffles and the party first arrived at Singapore in 1819, it was estimated that the island had a population of about 1,000 residents. They primarily relied on subsistence techniques for food, such as foraging fruits and hunting fishes. Current food sources and production were sufficient to sustain the current population, but for the trading settlement to survive its infancy and flourish, the population would have to expand rapidly. And just to illustrate how rapid, Singapore's population of 1,000 would multiply by 10 times over the next 5 years. With so many new mouths to feed, food logistics would also have to be expanded rapidly, which needed, you guessed it, money. Not to mention, developing a profitable trading settlement in a highly competitive environment from scratch required Farquhar to quickly plan and finance not only the construction of buildings and critical infrastructure, but also the execution and enforcement of various policy initiatives. When you factor in the short window of success, the ongoing threat of invasion by the Dutch, and a boss who was now basically missing in action, you start to see what an administrative nightmare Singapore was for the British, and one that Farquhar was dealing with. To jumpstart Singapore's economy, Farquhar first needed two basic ingredients, people and money. The good news was that Farquhar had developed quite a reputation for himself back when he was a colonial administrator in the British-occupied Malacca from 1795 to 1818. Though Malacca now rested in Dutch hands, Farquhar still had considerable influence in its merchant communities and maintained close rapport with wealthy businessmen. So, when he requested for supplies and settlers, the Malaccans obliged. They risked Dutch sanctions and ignored travel bans to Singapore, migrating to the new colony. Together with these early pioneers came their trading businesses, capital for investment, leadership expertise, and other essential resources such as food that is enough to feed the new population for the moment. While the question of people had answered itself, the monetary end of the equation, however, was where Farquhar faced complications. The bulk of government revenue in entreports like Singapore came from custom duties, which was basically eliminated by this whole free trade concept. And without financial support from the company, he had to find other means of raising revenue. His biggest solution? The auctioning of monopoly licenses for vices. Opium, alcohol, and gambling operations were the usual suspects. These monopoly licenses practically funded a large portion of the government expenditure and administrative upkeep in Singapore. Of course, this was not a wholly original concept if you consider the fact that the British East India Company was basically running on a monopoly license itself. But the idea of maintaining a colony with monopoly licenses was pretty much unheard of. It was so profitable that it would remain as the single largest source of government revenue in Singapore for the next 90 years. Essentially, Singapore was being built on the vices and pleasures of the Asian people. For now, the population was tiny and new. The effects of these social vices had not yet become widespread or apparent. About 4 months after Raffles had left, on the 31st of May 1819, he returned to Singapore. Under Farquhar's administration, the burgeoning trading settlement was shaping up pretty well so far. Thrilled by its progress, he sent a letter to his patron, the Duchess of Somerset. This is a small snippet of what he wrote about Singapore. "It is a child of my own, and I have made it what it is. You may easily conceive with what zeal I apply myself to the clearing of forests, cutting of roads, building of towns, framing of laws, etc." Nowhere in this letter was Farquhar ever credited or even mentioned, a red flag for what was to come later. In any case, Raffles made additional arrangements for his Singapore. He signed another treaty with the Sultan, this time to properly define the bounds of the British trading post. He also initiated urban planning efforts to assign residential areas for each ethnic community and appointing representatives within each to oversee and settle disputes in their respective spheres. On the 28th of June 1819, less than a month later, Raffles departed again. He would not return to Singapore until October 1822, more than 3 years later. In the time that followed, Farquhar's attempts at communications with Raffles in Bencoolen and the Calcutta office of British India would be met with tardy and vague replies. Without strong directives from his superiors, Farquhar would have to operate on his own. We will return on the 27th of December, and in the next episode, the work continues. Left to his own devices, Farquhar will spearhead Singapore's development. When Raffles is back in Singapore for a third and final time, it will be a remarkably different place. Trade is booming, the population is exploding, and the settlement is flourishing. But he will be less than satisfied with Farquhar's performance. Things are about to turn ugly, and the two men will lock horns over the management of Singapore.